The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are the Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Is US Policing Out of Control?, was recorded at the Guardian offices, London, in November 2015. Here's the chair, Guardian columnist Hugh Muir.
Okay, well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to our Guardian Newsroom Live event for this evening. Is US policing out of control? You may wonder, it would not be unreasonable for you to wonder whether or not we were prescient in holding this event this evening, or whether or not this was just another day in the life of America. But let me give you the headlines. In Minneapolis today, there have been five people shot in a demonstration that was related to the police shooting of 24-year-old Jamar Clark last November. And in Chicago, a police officer charged today with first-degree murder for the shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. He was actually shot 16 times last October. That's just what's happened in the last 24 hours. So that perhaps gives an immediacy to the subject we're discussing today. Let me give you a list of names. Some of them, unfortunately, you will recognise. In a better world, they would mean nothing to you. Alas, we do not live in that world yet. Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, Richard Davis, Walter Scott. All black men who in the recent past have had encounters with the US police and have not survived them. It's a scandal. Until recently, it was pretty much a hidden scandal. Deaths random, geographically spread across the country, unexplained in terms of motive and ferocity, uncollated, making it difficult to build a true picture. And that's where The Guardian came in. In the summer, Guardian US launched a project. They called it The Counted. And for the first time, they counted across the US shootings, but particularly shootings of young black men. And from a micro and a macro view, what they found was shocking. You'll hear about that this evening. Let me just tell you who we have with us this evening. Involved in the collation of that Guardian project was Oliver Lachlan, and he'll talk to you about that in just a moment. A figure familiar to, I'm sure, all of you, who's just ended, I think, a 10-year stint in the US, casting his eye over, among other things, race and inequality in the States. And he is Gary Young, our editor-at-large here at The Guardian. Also with us is Rene Edo-Lodge, who's been at the heart of the debate as to whether or not we in Britain also need a Black Lives Matter debate. You'll hear from her. And just next to me, Christopher Phelps. He's an associate professor of American history at Nottingham University. Now, I mentioned in that list of names Walter Scott, and I want to dwell on that for just a moment, because there's a danger, especially sitting here in King's Place, that this has an esoteric quality to it, that thousands of miles away in this citadel of truth that's King's Place, we don't quite appreciate the depth of the scandal that this is. That's not quite the case in quite germane to Walter Scott's case, because, of course, his case was captured famously on film by a passerby with a phone. It was posted onto YouTube. You may have seen it, you may not, but we wanted to show it at the outset. At least it encapsulated, I suppose, the act and the immediate cover-up as well. This is the hero of this particular story. That's Fidin Santana, and he shot that film. Here's the villain of that story, Michael Slager. And he's now facing a murder charge. But let's not forget the victim. That's Walter Scott. He was a forklift driver, and they wanted to talk to him about a traffic violation. And you saw how that ended up. Let me go to our panel. Just give me just 1 minute, just very quickly, of what's your sense when you watch that film? Renee?
Well, I'm disgusted. And actually what I was thinking when I was watching it is just, why? How could a traffic violation, you know, escalate to the point in which a man who's running away from a police officer is being shot? Having come back from the US, I was in the US for 3 weeks and I just literally just got back last week. Some of those questions, why? You know, I think when you're in London, it's very difficult to understand the political atmosphere of a country in which this repeatedly happens. But some of the questions were answered, and some of those answers, they weren't comfortable, they weren't nice answers. But when I watched that, I mean, the mind just boggles. And then to watch the cover-up as well, so blatant and so just so unapologetic. And then the final thought that I had watching that was, well, thank God for smartphones, really, and that people can capture this, because, I mean, I have no doubt that this sort of situation has happened in the past and there wasn't somebody to document it.
Thanks very much, Gary.
Well, yeah, I mean, taking up from there, it's like if a tree, you know, falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? If a black man gets shot in that situation and it's not recorded, is it still a crime that's been committed? Because that is the nature of... I mean, the thing is, it's not the nature of daily life insofar as... I don't know that is happening every day, but the fact of being black in America is that it could happen to you on any day. And if you looked at the news reports that came afterwards, the whole thing was entirely painted in this kind of very plausible, deniable manner, which only is only burst open by the video. And so one of the troubling things is that's what it takes. That's what it takes. You have to catch them red-handed shooting somebody dead in order for the brutality of the statistics of who's getting shot and who's shooting them and the circumstances in which they're shot to actually be driven home. And as we all know in our daily lives, if you take any moment where somebody is misbehaving, is out of line, to actually catch them red-handed is going to be very, very, very rare. And in a case like that, it's not even he said, it's he said, and he's dead. So the person who could make the case one way or another isn't, one of the people who could make the case one way or another, isn't around to make their own case.
Well, Oliver, thank you, Gary. Oliver, it's almost the casualness and the cold efficiency of it that's unnerving, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I watch it back, and I went out to South Carolina to cover the shooting, and I've been back a couple of times since. I was at Walter Scott's funeral. I have been to the site where he was shot a number of times. But for me, when I watch it back, the person I think about is Fidan Santana, who you mentioned. I interviewed him a few months ago, and his story is fascinating. He filmed that, obviously, at the scene of the crime, stood and shouted to the officers, as he told me, I saw what happened, and I have video of it, and they ignored him and allowed him to walk off. And it took him 2 days before he was confident enough to be able to hand that video over to Mr. Scott's lawyers because he feared for his life. And I think that kind of underlines the issue as well that we've all been talking about. He did not trust the police that were there essentially to protect him, to hand over key evidence in what is now a murder trial. So obviously I've seen the footage lots and lots of times. I mean, what you mentioned there about, you know, how quickly he concocted the story. We married up what you've got there is Slager's radio track, so the police scanner audio with the eyewitness video, and it took him 7 seconds to radio in that Mr. Scott had attempted to take his taser, and obviously without trying to prejudice a murder trial, it looks very clearly to me that that isn't what happened. So... you know, the quickness at which a story like that is concocted is incredibly interesting as well.
Christopher, what do you draw from that film when you see that again?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to salute The Guardian for this project on counting. Mark Twain, the American comic writer said that there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, but in this case it seems to me that statistics are being gathered that expose the damned lies. And it's as a historian that I watch, of course, it's just horrible, and I've seen it several times, but, I think about the pathologization of African-American men and the way in which criminality, immorality, danger, and so forth are associated with black skin in American history, which, of course, goes all the way back to slavery, a system that in order to enforce labor discipline, violence was just part and parcel of the daily life, and then to Jim Crow segregation with lynching. But if I take a little glimpse of hope in this moment, it seems to me that, that the American historian David Roediger, who coined the phrase whiteness as a way to describe white American working class men's way of sort of feeling some compensation for their own class oppression by sensing themselves as better than black people. I was talking to him just a few months ago, and he said he was on a panel in which all the other participants were African American, and one of his colleagues, who's very big on this question, asked them all in turn, when did the civil rights movement begin? And every single one of them, he said with the murder of Emmett Till, and then Emmett Till's mother showing the casket open in Chicago. This is 1955. And it seems to me that what's happening right now is a kind of collective sentience that this is a mass problem, when, of course, things like this have happened for decades. Mm. And yet now we understand it as something that requires redress. There's a movement afoot to try to address it, the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I sense that we're at a political moment of possibility here, not just horror.
Okay, thank you so much. Of course, the important thing is information. And we at The Guardian very much felt that, which was why we embarked upon this project, The Counted. Oliver is here, and so I'm going to ask him to just take us through it and tell us the genesis of it and what we learned from it.
So I'm here, and my colleague John Swain, who's very sorry he couldn't be here in person, is also here somewhere on Skype. So I'll just tell you a little bit about half of it, and then John will take over and we'll try and do it as quickly as we can. So The Counted was born out of a very startling fact, and that is that the US federal government keeps absolutely no reliable record of the number of people that are killed by police in the United States. The only statistics that they have are from a group of statistics called the FBI Annual Crime Trends. Now, last year, this counted 444 deaths, or justifiable homicides, as they're known, at the hands of US law enforcement throughout the whole of 2014. But the flaw with this data is that departments, and there are about 18,000 law enforcement agencies throughout the United States, and that's worth repeating, 18,000 when we have about a dozen in the UK. The flaw is that the departments only voluntarily submit their data. So last year, when they counted 444 deaths, only 224 police departments voluntarily submitted their data. In short, there are gaping holes. John and I went back through 10 years' worth of the FBI justifiable homicide stats and found that not a single police department in the entire state of Florida submitted one record of a death. The New York Police Department, the world's largest police department, has only submitted data once in the past decade. Now, what this means, essentially, is that names like Eric Garner, who died last year, are not counted by the federal government. Tamir Rice, as well, was not counted by the federal government because Cleveland Police Force did not submit any data on the issue. So I guess if we return to the title of what this debate is US policing out of control? I think everybody who works on The Counted, and there are a lot of us in the US, would say yes, but probably for slightly different reasons than you might imagine. We have no reliable official data on the number of people killed by police across the country. It means we cannot quantify the size of the issue at hand, the demographics involved, so whether certain minorities are targeted more, whether younger or older people are targeted more, what the gender breakdown is, which departments may have particular issues with officer-involved shootings, and broadly, in which states it's a bigger issue. If we can't understand the problem, how can we control it? So this call for reliable data was one of the clearest demands that emanated from the protests and unrest that emanated out of the death of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, which happened back in August last year. I wasn't actually in the US when that happened. John did some brilliant reporting from the ground there, and I think he's going to talk to you a little bit about that. But it's not just the deaths in 2014 where this demand was made. We can talk about, as Hughes mentioned, you know, the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, Maryland, death of Walter Scott, as we've already discussed, death of Tony Robinson in Madison, Wisconsin, who was killed by another white police officer. Mr. Robinson was black. The list goes on. But basically, whenever you go out and cover these protests, which John and I have done and other reporters at The Guardian have done, one of the very clear demands that comes from people out on the streets is that we do not have the data, we do not know how to quantify this issue, and that's what we need. And so that's why we launched The Counted. I guess to sort of describe what we do, we would say it's an exhaustive, open-sourced, long-term investigative project that aims to count every single death across the entire country at the hands of law enforcement. We launched at the beginning of June this year, and at that point we documented 464 deaths for the year so far. Now, you'll note that's 22 more than the FBI had documented for the whole of 2014. Now, as we reach the end of the year, and it's still not quite the end of the year, and this is the last time I check because the number goes up every day, the death toll stands at 1,024 for the year. That's a rate of 3.14 a day. Now, of course, included in that total are, you know, a huge array of circumstances. We can talk about individuals who have opened fire on cops, brandished firearms, been involved in some sort of criminal activity before they were killed. But we classify this data in lots and lots of different ways. And one of the things we look at is whether a suspect was armed at the time they were killed. And strikingly, 20% of these 1,024 deaths, the individuals were entirely unarmed. And I say entirely unarmed because police in the US, or at least certain departments, have an interesting habit of talking about what constitutes being armed. So we've looked at cases where, well, there was one in Alabama where an officer said the reason he opened fire was because an individual wielded a spoon at him with aggressive intent. The guy died. Staplers as well have been used as reasons for opening fire. Vehicles are a very common one as well. People will say that they've been driven up towards by a suspect and so they've been forced to open fire. And on top of that 20%, 6% of the cases that we've looked at, it's undetermined whether the person was carrying a weapon or not. And we obviously go back to these cases as much as we possibly can, try and follow up and find out what the real circumstances are. When you break that unarmed statistic down by race, it becomes even more stark. So 26% of the 261 black people that were killed by police this year have been unarmed. 20% of the 164 Hispanic or Latino people who were killed this year by police were unarmed. Only 17% of the 509 white people killed so far by police this year were unarmed. So I'll take you through very, very quickly how we do it. I think you might have seen a bit in the video. It's important to say, as I tried to say at the beginning, we're a huge team. John and I are the senior reporters on it. We have a fantastic writer, researcher called Jamal Zlate, who does a lot of the working with us, and Kira McCarthy as well has joined as an intern and researcher, and she's fantastic. Along with that, we have a brilliant interactive team who have designed the entire sort of interface that we have that is, you know, the sort of, I guess, the workings, you know, the inner part of the whole project, and an audience team as well. And audience is really at the heart of this project. We rely on tip-offs and submissions from our audience throughout the US. We've got 15,000 followers on Twitter, 17,000 on Facebook. And what that means is that they submit information about cases when somebody's died or when there's been an update in a case. And that keeps us ahead of the game. We're often ahead of local media, in just reporting when a death has occurred or when a ruling has been made in some of these cases. So that's kind of what keeps us going. And I guess what it's enabled us to do in the initial stages anyway, and I think John will talk about the second stage of the project, which is slightly more expansive thematic stuff. It's enabled us to look for cases that go unreported. And so when we launched with a number of cases that had been entirely underreported by local media. So John worked on a story about William Chapman, who was an unarmed black 18-year-old who was shot and killed by police in Portsmouth, Virginia. He was shot by a white officer, and that officer had killed before. as a result of our reporting, and in particular John's reporting, I think, that officer has now been charged with murder, and the family, you know, thank us for doing that. They sort of see that what we did there was a real reason for why those, you know, charges came to fruition. I, as well, when we launched, looked at the case of a guy called Emilica Perez Lopez, who was a 20-year-old Guatemalan migrant who was shot 6 times from behind by officers in San Francisco. We're still awaiting outcomes on those charges, but, you know, following our reporting, the police chief in San Francisco was forced to change the story about how it all happened. And those are just two examples of cases where the reporting in local media wasn't up to scratch, basically. You know, it may have been noted, it may have been documented, but there was more to the story. And I think, you know, by having this database and being able to search and look for things like this and look for trends, we're able to go and get cases like that. And that's part of the mission. But I think, hopefully, John is now behind me.
Yes. Can you hear us, John?
Has he been behind me the whole time?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, it's near Christmas, so we have the panto element. John, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, about the latest stage of The Counted.
Well, I'm here just wrapping up some of the reporting that we're doing to finish off, really, to sum up what we found, to look at where in the US this is a particular problem. I don't want to give too much away in case some of our rivals are watching, but it should be some pretty good reporting we've been doing. We've got some video and some reporting and some data and some records, and we really hope that we can shed some light on where this is really happening and where this is a particular problem. I wanted to mention Ferguson. Ollie mentioned Ferguson, obviously, and it's quite a significant date today. It's exactly a year since the city of Ferguson in Missouri basically went up in flames because a grand jury, which, I mean, we actually abolished grand juries in the UK, I think, in the 1930s. They're more like secret trials. Decided that this white police officer would not be charged with the crime for shooting Michael Brown, who was this black unarmed 18-year-old. And that really, I think, for a lot of the US, and certainly for me, is where this story really began, or certainly was given an enormous boost in terms of relevance. I was sent there probably because the chief reporter was on holiday, but stayed there a week and covered the protests, which were small but growing, and lived through the tear gas and the rubber bullets and the kind of drama that erupted there and made it the center of the US. But what I wanted to stress was that although we're here tonight talking about these shootings and other deaths caused by police, and obviously what happened in Ferguson was triggered by a death of a young man who was shot by the police, what really shone through when I was there and when I spoke to residents there was that, yeah, this was the kind of spark that lit the tinderbox there. But actually, a generation there, a young generation, largely young African-American men, feel not only mistreated by the police, but also stolen, robbed even of their livelihood sometimes and of their money. The city of Ferguson, the bureaucracy there, survives and is run essentially on aggressive court revenue collection. And what that means is the police go out every day and ticket black drivers and fine local black poor residents, usually, because the richer, whiter residents know how to escape these charges. And that's how the city runs. And there's a sort of caste system in place where the whole system, the whole city is funded by these lower income residents who in Ferguson tend to be African-American. And you see these lines around the block queuing up for the court. And this really was what they wanted to explain. This is what they didn't think anyone in the US really realized, that this was a city that was being operated in this sort of archaic and unfair way. And only this shooting had actually attracted enough media for them to explain what their lives were like. And meanwhile, we at The Guardian, we found out that the judge who was actually enforcing this regime owed $170,000 in his own back taxes while he was charging these people to run the city. And so that's what we've tried to do with this project, I think it's fair to say, not only to record the deaths and the shootings, but to fill in the gaps and to do the reporting around what these shootings and what these incidents mean to people, and to try to shed light on some of these communities that have been underserved by the media, underserved by politicians. And, you know, Ollie went through a few of the statistics that we found earlier on. And as we've gone on with the project, we've tried to really focus on what we've found in the data and tried to pull out bigger trends that we've spotted that maybe people didn't spot. And some of them, for example, are that more than 100 people who were killed this year were suicidal. And sometimes the medical examiners and the coroners in these cases actually define their death as a suicide, even though the police shot them. And so in a way, the responsibility for the police is taken away. And a medical examiner, a chief medical examiner for Oregon, told us that she feels like she frequently comes under pressure to rule these police shootings as suicides, to kind of let the police off the hook. And this is a trend that hadn't really been given enough attention, and we thought that we'd really unearthed it with this database that we've been running. And so we put more attention on it and wrote an investigative article on it. And similarly, the topic of tonight obviously is whether police are under control. And I think, as Oliver touched on, one reason why police literally are out of the control of government is that the federal system in the United States means that this 18,000 or some law enforcement agencies are really not controllable by President Obama, say, or the Department of Justice, which I think some people in Europe, I certainly did when I lived there, don't initially understand, don't appreciate. And one of the issues we reported on was how dozens of people are dying every year in moving cars. They're being shot often as they drive away from these confrontations with the police. There was a young man, only 19 years old, in South Carolina earlier this year, Zach Hammond. He was being set up in a kind of marijuana buying sting. He tried to drive away presumably because he was scared and didn't want to be arrested. And the policeman who was standing in the way while he jumped out of the way of the car also shot him dead. And we found something like 30 cases where these incidents are happening. And the Department of Justice says, don't do this. The International Association of Chiefs of Police say, don't do this. All these authorities who try to sort of guide police departments say, don't do this. But the departments are out there on their own, and they really set their own rules. And so what we've been trying to do is find out the rules that these individual departments operate by. And I think with these longer articles that Oliver mentioned, we've hopefully shed some light on that.
Okay, cool. Okay. Thank you very much. Let me bring in Gary here, because you were in the US for 10 years, and I assume that when this information came through, that was really just statistical confirmation of things that you'd been thinking all along. But what's going on here? Because I suppose no one sets out to have a police service that's out of control or policing that's out of control. So why is this happening?
There are a few reasons. I mean, one, without letting the police off the hook at all, if you go back to the early 80s when the late Stuart Hall wrote a pamphlet called Policing the Crisis, and it was about the nature of policing in the early Thatcherite years and the way in which the economic crisis, the massive unemployment following the kind of shock therapy, how that was being almost militarized on the street. And so you have these areas in America where there are no jobs, post-industrial moonscapes. There's no jobs. There's very little education going on in the schools. The schools are abysmal. There are no social services. There's no health service, like mental health service. So anybody who's got a mental health problem, well, you're on your own. The biggest provider of mental health in America is the prisons. And then you throw two things onto that. First of all, guns, the ready availability of guns, and then an armed police force. And that is, in no small part, the kind of framework for these kind of things. Another thing that has to be borne in mind is that when we think of America, we think of this hyper-modern, very, very kind of... we think of America as our future, all too often in Britain, and all too sadly, I think. And that my wife is African-American. Her parents grew up under segregation. They went to segregated colleges, went to segregated schools. That this is not that long ago that America was an apartheid state. Uh-huh. It's in living memory of, you know, it's in, when my child in Black History Month, there or here, wanted to know about segregation, and say, ask your granddad, ask your grandmother. And so if one expands the notion of Black Lives Matter to what we're really talking about. Well, then there was a time when a black life could be literally measured in dollars and cents. That was slavery. and then there was a time when they got rid of slavery but kept a kind of sense of enforcement under segregation. And then what they would do is every now and then they would there would be a lynching and they would leave the body hanging for a couple of days so that everybody could see the price of transgression. And now we're in this post-civil rights moment where there is formal equality and yet obviously rampant inequality. And a few stats really kind of really run this home. The life expectancy of a black male in DC is lower than the life expectancy of a man on the Gaza Strip. Infant mortality in Chicago is on a par with, black infant mortality is on a par with infant mortality on the West Bank. That in the American prison system at the moment, there are more people than there were in the Gulag, in the Russian Gulag, at its height. So you're talking about a criminalized, impoverished, sick, but physically sick, health-wise sick, community, which then somehow has to be controlled. And so when you ask, you know, how do these things happen, I think if you tie those economic factors, those social factors, in with that historical reality, and then you say to the police, control this, that you have a situation where the people that they're controlling are not actually seen as people. They're seen as things that have to be controlled. Hence, Black Lives Matter. You know, this notion when, and so we're in this contradictory moment where nobody now doubts that you can have a black president. That question has been settled, but the sanctity of black life has not been settled. And so the question of these people being human beings, of there being any account need to be made for removing them from the planet, is what we're arguing for. Because what you see in that video in South Carolina is another one gone. Mm. And no one's going to ask any questions. And if they do ask any questions, then the explanation is simple. And it's simple. As soon as you put his picture up, everyone will know, well, then, obviously, something bad happened. Mm. Something, sorry, that he did something to deserve this.
Thanks, Gary. Christopher Phelps, to what extent is this a perversion of the American psyche, and to what extent is it just true to the American psyche in terms of the ferocity of it, the racial disproportions? To what extent is actually this in tune with what we know of America?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more with everything Gary just said. I thought it was extremely perceptive. And what you're getting at, though, is that more and more Americans in the census identify themselves as multiracial. More and more families are multiracial. You look at me right now, you see a white male American. My brother's Korean. My sister's Vietnamese. My brother-in-law is Colombian. And I could go on, but the point being that families are crisscrossed with all sorts of identities, national and racial. And it was people like my grandmother. I can remember when I was growing up in Iowa in the 70s, 60s and 70s, my grandfather, who was a wonderful guy, really, a model for me in many ways, would say racist things that I didn't understand at the time, but I now realize were. My grandmother, who was married to him and long outlived him, just recently died in her late 90s, voted for Barack Obama twice. So Americans are contradictory and Americans are changing. And what your question gets at is sort of the problem of the whole American project. From the Revolution onward, the notion of freedom and liberty were essential to the American credo. It's right there in the Declaration of Independence, which begins, "All men are created equal," which we understand now to be gendered, but at the time was a statement of human equality. And yet that was written by somebody who owned slaves, Thomas Jefferson. And that dialectic of freedom and oppression is deep in American history. In fact, you could argue that the reason why certain Americans so deeply valued their freedom was precisely that they understood in their daily life what it would have been like to not be free, because they identified themselves as free by virtue of the fact that the people that they owned were not. Where it all goes, I don't know. But as I was saying, I think that there's something important, and I think Rennie is right about the digital age being key here and cameras and so forth. But the fact that this is now of great public attention and concern to huge numbers of people, and that there is publicity being addressed to it, indicates that there's a possible movement building that. And it's bigger, by the way, than just killings of people by police. It's the entire, I think, carceral state, the project of locking up an entire generation of black youth for petty offenses, you know, possession of small amounts of marijuana, things like that, wrecking whole lives. And then if you're a felon, what that does to your job prospects and so forth, it just compounds everything Gary's talking about in terms of unequal playing field and economic deprivation. But there's now just a sort of mass reconsideration of all that, and where it all goes, who knows, because we also still have the Yahoo comport in American politics, the Trumps and so forth at the door. So it's all in play.
Rennie, this is obviously something that you feel very strongly about. You've written articles about it. I think you wrote one saying, "These cases make me scared to have my own children, knowing that black and brown skin is perceived as a threat in so many minds. The system that reproduces this seems insurmountable." Is it from here you feel this is such an important issue? Why in Britain is this something that you feel about so strongly?
I feel that it is a problem in Britain just because less than a handful of months ago, a black man in Scotland was shot dead by the police and his family still fighting for justice, Shekhar Bayo. Yeah. And I think the problem is that the reason why I feel that this is a continued threat to black and brown bodies in the UK is because what I can see happening to Shekhar Bayo's family, which is that the police are changing their story and covering up and hauling the police officers who actually shot him into the staff room to discuss matters with them before they give a statement. Mm. That's why I'm scared. But I think just to riff off what Gary was saying, and we've heard lots of really interesting things about the American political philosophy about liberty and freedom, and how this doesn't work for black people in the US, particularly as I think that people who are black people born and bred in the US are treated as like aliens in their own country. But one thing that was going around in my mind was in this historical context of, you know, the Constitution speaks of the right to bear arms, and this like rampant individualism that I think sometimes lacks empathy, is there's a few things to remember, which is one, that the police are not neutral, that they're not objective, and that they're absolutely part of the society that they're policing, right? So we can't talk about structural racism in the United States without talking about structural racism in the police force, in the many police forces, because anybody can become a police officer. Any random person who has an unlearned racism in their minds can become a police officer, and then they're given a gun and told, go and police your local community. Like, there's no are you racist or not tests before somebody goes to sign up to be a police officer. And so I think that we constantly have to remind ourselves that racism is something that we consistently reproduce in all of our interactions with each other, whether or not we are police officers or not, that we have to catch ourselves and unlearn. Yeah. And, like, I'm of the opinion that if we don't recognise how we're reproducing racism, then it's going to be impossible to tackle. And that's what I was referring to when I said this feels like an almost insurmountable task, because I could individually do that every day, but, you know, I'm just one person in a world of billions. I think it's really what's really interesting, particularly about The Counted, is that it's a UK newspaper, The Guardian, that's taken on this task when there's hundreds of newspapers in the US. And I think it's important to ask why that's the case. But yeah, I think the UK, I think the climate here, the political climate is different. And I absolutely don't think that the US needs to be our future. You know, just after the Paris attacks, when we had that reignited discussion of, you know, should our police forces be empowered with the right to shoot to kill? What a horrible idea. What an absolutely horrible idea. And we have to consistently catch ourselves in this country to make sure that we don't move into a society where the domestic is militarised in this way.
OK, because we are The Guardian, because we are open, I will be coming to you for your questions. So if you have any thoughts, do jot them down and I'll be coming to you for those in a moment. But I think Oliver wanted to come in and Gary wanted to come in.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to your point about, you know, anybody becoming a police officer and racism being learned and that sort of thing. I mean, I was down in Baltimore covering the death of Freddie Gray, and John was with me. We had a big reporting team out there doing it. And when you go to the west side of Baltimore, which is one of the most confrontingly deprived areas of the world I've ever been to in my entire life, you talk to people about their relationship with police there, and the force is about 40 to 45% black. And yet the conversation still revolves around racism, and it revolves around a police force that doesn't work for them. And the reason it doesn't work for them, they say, or some of the people I spoke to say, is because they're not from the community. They move out of Baltimore. You know, they may have been born there, but it's a sort of opportunity to move on and move upwards. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring that up because I thought it was an interesting sort of insight and example of what you were talking to.
Gary, I think you wanted to...
So a couple of things. The first was, one of the first things that I was struck by when you when The Counted first came out was the fact that most people who are shot dead by the police or are killed by the police are white. Now, proportionally, black people are still more likely to be killed. But it kind of bifurcates the question in a way, which is the police out of control? Yes. Is the police racist? Yes. And then you bring those two answers together and you have an out-of-control police force killing large numbers of black people, or a disproportionate number of black people. But they are also terrorising poor white communities too, which is a point worth bearing in mind, not to shift from Black Lives Matter to All Lives Matter or anything like that, but to understand the nature of the beast, because we take Baltimore, black mayor, black police chief, some of the officers involved were black, then one has to grapple with the systemic nature of this problem. It's not about bad white people killing good black people. The black people may not be good. That does not mean that they deserve to die. You know, when people raise that, well, Mike Brown stole some cigarillos. Last time, even if that's true, last time I looked, stealing cigarillos was not, you
definitely.
Know, yeah, was not punishable by summary death without even a trial.
Yeah.
And the police officer doesn't need to be a bad person. He just needs to operate in a system where the price for taking a black man out of the planet is zero, and where you know that if you pull the trigger on this one, it's not going to be a problem, that your chief will bag you up in exactly the same way that if someone goes down to Bethnal Green sometime tonight and shoots a young Asian kid, they will be able to cite all sorts of probable causes that they wouldn't be outside if they were in Putney. Could be a similar situation.
Yeah.
It wouldn't matter. So there's that. The other thing, and this is just to kind of complicate it in a way, I mean, I do think that it's telling that it took a British paper to do this, or British news organisation to do this. I think that's about proximity. I think if during the Troubles, if you're looking for a good account of what was going on in Northern Ireland, I would probably have gone to the Boston Globe. I don't think that Britain covered the Troubles well. That British people would say, well, you don't understand, they're bombing us, these people are this, these people are that. And that having that one stage removed is actually very important in terms of asking the very basic question, which is, why is nobody watching the store? I mean, that's the question that the Counted really raises, is you're a reporter, you want to know how many people have been shot dead, and then you find out that nobody knows. Well, if you're American and you know that there are 18,000, you know, or however many thousand police forces, and, you know, they all work separately, that has been kind of, you know, imbibed. You know, you've taken that in with your mother's milk. If you're a foreigner, any kind of foreigner, you come in, you're like, well, what the hell is this? And I don't think that would be any different than if an American comes here in 88, 89 and says, why do you have Jerry Adams on television moving his lips and an actor saying his words? What the hell kind of world is that you're living in? And within a couple of years, that was the new normal, and we'd all become accustomed to it.
Because the other thing that always links the debate between policing in the US and here is whether or not the police want to be a police service or to be a police force. Christopher, it seems to me that the sort of policing that we're talking about is done by people who are absolutely convinced that they are a police force and not a police service. And aided, of course, by, in the States, a lot of military hardware that a lot of police forces were given by the Pentagon.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's now a militarization of the police, which I think also is a target of the movement. And, I have actually a question, if I could throw it back at you Guardian people, which is, I've been sitting here thinking about Trayvon Martin, whose name hasn't come up, and 2012, who was shot in Florida, and then there was the George Zimmerman trial, and it was two black women who created the hashtag Black Lives Matter out of Trayvon's death, I believe. But Trayvon wouldn't be counted, because George Zimmerman was a kind of wannabe vigilante apartment cop, but he wasn't part of any police force. And then that got me also thinking about there's these horrible laws that are supposedly self-defense, which is a big American culture thing. I do understand now the British fascination with American violence. Every time I'm called on the BBC to speak, it's not, you know, anything I'm actually expert in. It's some American lunatic has shot up America, and they need an American voice first thing in the morning to explain my people. And I have now ceased doing this. I mean, at first I was like, oh, the World Service. Yeah. My name is lights, and now I just categorically refuse to try to explain American violence, because I don't have the answers. I really don't have the answers about why America is the way it is. But what does interest me, though, is that these new laws, which basically are sort of, you know, my home is my castle kind of thing, and I can blow away anybody on my property for any reason. That's what the new laws are like, and they're kind of NRA right-wing laws. I'm putting this together with Trayvon Martin, because I suspect that if we, you know, and this is a massive task you would have, I assume that's why you drew the line at public agencies that can be held accountable by political movements. But in the culture writ large, it wouldn't surprise me to see equally racist patterns of gun violence in neighborhoods of the kind that Trayvon Martin experienced, just going out to get a bag of chittles, candy.
No, absolutely. I mean, obviously, we just had to draw the line somewhere, and there's only four of us.
but you make a good point, because I know, René, in the piece that you wrote, you were very angry about the level of support that I think the officer, was it Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown, got.
Absolutely.
So it's not just about the amount of the support that they get from within the force.
Yeah,
one might expect that, or law enforcement, but there's a certain amount of communal support as
well. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was completely blown away, I think, by just my short time in the US, just like under a month, the attitude towards guns and self-defense and this almost like, sorry to offend any Americans in the room, right, but it's almost like Marvel comic book understanding of justice, which is like the good guys need to have guns in case the bad guys have guns, you know. I met a man who told me he owned 60 guns. I don't know if it's a lie or not. And he said that when I asked him, what's the deal? What's the understand? I don't understand why you need this amount of guns. Like, as a British person, guns make me feel less safe, not more. And he said, have you ever heard of these gun-free zones that they have now? They're absolutely insane. It's a signal that anybody can walk into the room and shoot the place up and there'll be nobody there to protect them, right? And I started to understand that mentality of raising money for somebody who shot somebody, an innocent person, dead. Because if that person who shot them said, I did it in self-defense, this sort of like feeling of, yeah, he has the right to do that, if that person was posing a threat. You mix that up with racism and it's, well, what constitutes a threat? Is it black skin, you know?
Mm-hmm. Gary and then Oliver, and then we'll take some questions.
Well, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, I think there are, I'm not going to try and explain the whole thing because I can't, but that I think there are some almost anthropological things that one might say in terms of it's a settler culture. So from the beginning, from the moment that America was founded on the gun, and I've been to a couple of NRA conventions now, the National Rifle Association. It's one of those tasks I say to people, I do it so you won't have to. And people, I would say to people, look, I'm British. I don't get it. Explain it to me. And what they would do, almost to a person, three or four times this happened. This was how they would get me to their place. Are you married? Do you have children? Imagine someone came into, and then they would draw this kind of dystopian kind of hell in which, you know, I mean, you know, within minutes, my wife has been raped, my children have been massacred. What are you going to do? You gonna wait for the police? And so there is this thing about public service, like you know, run down public services, because these people would all be, some of them are former cops, but also like this appeal to your masculinity.
Yeah, it's very.
But also this sense of homestead, that this is your home, you defend your home, which is born from a settler understanding. You clear some ground, you kill some Indians, you kind of, you know, you make it yours. And as soon as slaves come in, well, then you have to defend everything, because nobody's staying enslaved without the gun. And so that sense of fear and of, but also of control, I think can be kind of deeply rooted. Now, there are lots of settler cultures that don't have this gun culture, but there are very few settler cultures that didn't have this gun culture at some time. The other thing that I want to throw in, because I think it's important and this is what I've been doing, is I've finished a book that's not coming out until next year about all of the kids who get shot dead in one day in America. Now, every day, on average, 7 kids are shot dead in America. I picked a day at random, which was the 23rd of November, so just 2 days ago, in 2013, and decided to follow all of these cases, find out who these kids were, what, not actually relitigate their deaths, but to find out, you know, find their pastors, their parents, find out who they were. And a few things came out of that. First of all, that kind of Black Lives Matter is not simply one of the reasons why it could take hold, was because it wasn't simply about police shootings in a way, because this thing permeates into the minds of everybody. And so the notion that you might just shoot someone else also occurs to Black people. And not that I think this is a very as big a deal as some of the right-wing commentators make, but most black people who are shot dead by black people. Now, that is because America is a very segregated country, and most white people who are shot dead by white people. Yeah. And, you know, death.
Most people who shoot each other know each other.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Which is also true. Mm.
Yeah. And most people actually who are shot dead shoot themselves. Mm.
Yeah.
So, but that these deaths passed, by and large, unremarked by the media. And when you went to the journalist who wrote the paragraph and you said, did you follow up? And they'd say, it's not that uncommon that a child would get shot in that area. And so there are places in America where you're not supposed to get shot. Cinemas, schools, university campuses. But then there are areas, low-income black and Latino neighborhoods, where... you are supposed to get shot, where the fact, or at least the fact that you're getting shot, doesn't interrupt anybody's understanding of how your city or your world works. It actually just confirms it. And then finally, when you spoke to these parents, now this was 10 kids got shot dead on the day that I chose. Seven black, two Latino, one white. A range of circumstances, from a kid who opened a door and his mum's ex-lover just shot him in the head, he was nine, to kids at a sleepover, the dad leaves five guns out and they're loaded and they shoot each other. A range of circumstances. When you ask the parents, what do you think is happening? What do you think is going on here? Open-ended question. What do you think is going on here? Nobody mentions guns. Because it would be like mentioning traffic.
It's just there.
If your kid got run over, what are you going to do about traffic? Nothing. Guns aren't going anywhere. It's a hopelessness about guns. Nobody mentions poverty. Nobody mentions racism. They retreat to behavior, to parenting, to things that they might be able to control. And I think the reason that it's relevant is that it speaks to the Trayvon Martin question and a sense that... when we talk about police shootings, we're talking about something that we can call to account. But it is indicative of a broader problem, which is that, generally speaking, in America, black lives don't matter. And that that notion isn't limited by race or by profession.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even there are even black people who think black lives don't matter.
Very quickly, and then we'll just very quick, I just wanted to talk about what you were saying, you know, settler culture and how that sort of permeates police forces. So I went to the NYPD graduation ceremony this time last year, and I was just completely blown away with how the whole system operated. You know, before it all starts, there's sort of marching bands, and everybody who had served time in the military stands up and has their sort of song played. And it was probably about 25-30% of the people, I think, that were graduating that year who had, you know, past military service. And they play this sort of what can only really be described as kind of a propaganda video where, you know, you see cops running around with guns, you know, bomb disposal units, that sort of stuff. And nothing about community. And I think that is pervasive in other departments as well. You know, we mentioned the William Chapman case. That's in Portsmouth, Virginia, which is a naval town, and a lot of the officers who work for that force are ex-servicemen. And, you know, John uncovered the recruitment video there, and it's just extraordinary. It's basically like a military operation saying, come along, join our force. You can hang out with sniper rifles and go and catch bad guys. So yeah, I just wanted to add that because
and
I think it's kind of pervasive.
Just to wedge in some feminist critique here, there's something very, very patriarchal about this. This is very traditional gender roles, and, you know, that needs to be unpacked.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's take some questions. Well, you're straight in.
If I can just speak very briefly from a UK policing perspective. I'm Nick Keane, I work in the College of Policing, I'm a retired police officer. I think there's something in here about, without exculpating the police of racism and various other things.
I think you have a microphone as well.
Sorry.
We've got everything here at The Guardian.
Okay. that we still have a predominantly unarmed police service in this country. And from a police perspective and the narrative we tell ourselves, this is a very powerful thing. 2 years ago, we had two police officers killed. Nicola Hughes and Fiona Bone. And when I was a copper, every time we had a police officer killed, we had a vote, do we want to be armed? And every time we vote no. Oh. Now that percentage is changing and it's getting, it's eating towards an armed police service. And you can see semi-arming through tasers and stuff like that. But still the healthiest thing in this country, for the healthiest thing for this democracy, for all its fault, is we have an unarmed police service. And that is not done lightly by the police service. It's not a light thing, because we do know, and we feel it like a community, when we lose somebody, we feel the pain. But it is really important that for all the faults of the police service, and what I would say is, what I see from the American perspective is a polarisation between the community and the police service. What I dread in this country is we see that polarisation replicated, and that what we can do to ensure that our unarmed, predominantly unarmed police force, for all its faults, is kept feeling part of the community. I mean, it's not a question, it's a comment.
But there's a difference between our police force and the American police force, just the lack of guns here, or is it attitudinal?
If I have a concern, it is, with the rise of social media, you can see our police service becoming closer and closer allied towards the American model of policing, and you can see parts of the police service, particularly those that have guns, finding themselves caricaturing themselves as the armed police service and following those models. So I can see a risk there. What I think would be really important is the essentialness of our unarmed police service, and that is not a light decision. That we have lots of faults, but that is still something that makes us a democratic police service for all its faults.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really glad that you were here. I'm glad to take your contribution. You just there in the front. I'll come to you in a second. The mic's on over there.
Hi, yes, I was wondering what the political response had been to the campaigns that you've been running in America.
John, do you have a go at that?
What's the political reaction been?
So there's been a pretty muted reaction from the Republican side. They're not really keen to put pressure on law enforcement to be seen to be criticising them. But the other side, there's been quite a lot of two senior Democratic senators have proposed a bill in the Senate which would mandate the authorities, the FBI and the Department of Justice, to do what we're doing, to make sure that all these incidents are counted. The demographics of everyone who's died should be counted, whether they were armed, whether they were a man or a woman, whether they were black, Latino, white, all these things that we've been collecting, this bill would mandate. And unfortunately, it's sort of stuck at the moment because the Republicans control the Senate. But it is interesting, I think, the Democrats have got that kind of impetus behind them. And in terms of the administration, as they currently are, the FBI director, James Comey, a couple of weeks ago, in a kind of closed-door meeting with police chiefs and other government leaders, he said it was ridiculous and embarrassing that we and the Washington Post, who run a separate but sort of similar project, have better data than the government. And I think once people like that, once a kind of seasoned bureaucrat and a government leader starts admitting that publicly, I think you have touched a nerve. And I think they are determined to put it right. And in fact, the Department of Justice have in the recent weeks announced a pilot scheme, a new program, which kind of mirrors our program, in fact, where they, rather than in the system that Oliver described earlier, where it's a voluntary system and departments are relied upon to submit their numbers, under this new pilot scheme, they will proactively go out looking for cases. They will monitor the media. They will monitor social media. They will use counts like we've had this year and some amateur counts online as well, and follow up with departments and call coroners and ask for autopsies, just like we've been doing this year. Because they feel, and I think we've decided this is the only way, you're never going to get departments 100% reporting, and so you have to take proactive action. So we feel like we've made a pretty big impact, and we've just got to wait and see as the new year turns whether the government count actually amounts to much.
Thank you, John. And of course, when Donald Trump is president, we'll really make some headway. I think this lady here in the front, I think.
Hi, so this is for John and Oliver. Just wondering, you know, at the end of the year, this the counted is over, the program is done, but, you know, the problem still persists. What's next for the counted, you know, once you're done counting for this year?
It's a good question. I don't think we've 100% decided when the project finishes.
what we necessarily do with the data. As John mentioned, we've sort of moved on to the stage now where we're trying to identify broad trends, and we've got this sort of long-form series coming up about a particular place that we're looking at. You know, there are ideas that it may continue in other forms, so perhaps something that's funded outside, something like that. We don't know yet, but as John mentioned just then, the Justice Department has announced this pilot scheme, which is essentially copying us, which, you know, we're imitation, I guess, is the greatest form of flattery. So we'll be looking at that very closely, and I guess if it employs a model that we feel is doing as good a job as us, then perhaps our job is done. But I don't think there's been a proper decision made yet about how it progresses into 2016, other than to sort of reflect on 2015 and then see where to go from there.
Okay, take my advice. Buy several copies of The Guardian every day, and you can get an update from those. over there, and then. Okay.
Hi, it's a really great project, and you've been talking all night about different ways that statistics, hidden statistics, have been revealed, and particular demographics, and particularly the panel has talked about black male victims, and I wondered if you could, any of you, could talk about the Say Her Name movement and the women who seem to be a doubly hidden statistic as victim of black police violence.
Who would like to say that?
I mean, you're right, there is, I mean, there's a problem there, and the problem is, well, it's manifold, but like, first of all, there are a large number, and I don't know the percentage.
95%
of the people who are shot dead are black. Men, rather. And therefore, while it's not an exclusively male problem, it is a predominantly male problem, which does lead to a masculinization, if that is a word, of the conversation. I don't think women are... they are doubly hidden, if you like, but they're not doubly worse treated. They are differently badly treated. There was Sandra Bland most recently, yeah, who really came to the fore. There was, I'm blanking on her name, but the woman in Florida who shot through the roof with her husband. Every now and then, there is a woman who kind of breaks through and becomes a name that is said. My guess is that it probably is about 5% of the names that are said, you know, because very few of the names are said. All of that said, here's the thing. There are four men on this panel and one woman. The media is dominated by men. The police force is dominated by men. And so there's no doubt in my mind that women's experiences of this as victims of the shootings is marginalised. Women as a whole, I don't know that would be true, because if you look, when they go to the parents of the victim, like when you go to the relatives of the victims, it's primarily the women who speak. And yeah. I think that given the numbers, that's largely how most of the women who are impacted by this violence, the way that they're impacted by this violence is by being mothers or partners or children of the 95% of the men.
Just quickly, and then I want to go to Ray.
Yeah, just from the reporter's point of view, you know, we've spoken a little bit about some of the longer read pieces that we've been doing, and whenever we do come across a case that we think fits with some of the broader trends we're examining and it's a woman, we try and include it. So I just finished up working on a piece about use of tasers, and one of the banner cases in that was the death of a lady called Natasha McKenna. She's an African-American woman who was tasered four times and died. She was in a county jail in Virginia, and it's honestly one of the most haunting cases I have ever written about. It was all filmed on camera. She was paranoid schizophrenic, and they were trying to move her from a cell because she had was having a, undergoing a sort of violent episode. Six sheriff's deputies turned up at her door, all dressed in hazmat suits and had a riot shield, pushed her up against the wall and struggled with her for about 25 minutes before using the taser while she was in restraints. She's then wheeled through the county jail. The officers don't realise that she's dead. And the whole thing is captured on video. So there are, as Gary says, you know, a number of incredibly shocking cases, and whenever we can, we try and report them. But, yeah, I mean, it's just from the demographics we look at, it's overwhelmingly males that are involved in, you know, in the deaths. So.
When you speak about the role of women in this, not just as victims, but obviously as campaigners as well.
I mean, Christopher said quite rightly that it's women who started the Black Lives Matter movement, and yeah, at the moment I'm busy doing a bunch of interviews and research for my book that's coming out in early 2017, look out for it. And one of the things that always strikes me, and that campaigners, particularly who worked in the UK as well as the US, have said, is that whenever an injustice happens to a black man, it's always women who come out fighting for justice, always women. You know, the lawyers I've spoken to have said, you know, when this happens, the first person who's in its office is a wife or a mother. Now, if you contrast that with, say, a case that's currently unfolding in the US, the Daniel Holtzclaw case, I don't know if anybody's following this. It's not about black women being shot and killed by the police, but actually there's this case that's transpired in the US in which a white police officer, Daniel Holtzclaw, has allegedly been using his police status to go around sexually assaulting older black women, stopping them for minor violations, running their names through his little machine to find out whether they're, you know, they've got an outstanding this or that, and then basically sexually assaulting them. And actually, there's been silence, I would say, from some quarters of campaigning, and that to me is incredibly troubling because it's always women who come out, you know, all forces. Fighting for their husbands, their boyfriends, their male relatives. And I'm needing to see black men stand up and say, this Daniel Holtzclaw thing is absolutely disgusting. I mean, BuzzFeed did an incredibly interesting long read on it. I would recommend that you go and have a look.
I could just say one thing, if that's okay, about women in the protest movement.
There he is. Go ahead.
Just quickly, it was touched on just then, but I really think that's true, that about Black Lives Matter, some of the leaders that have come out of that movement, the founders as well, are women. There was a fantastic case in South Carolina, Bree Newsom is her name, that when the massacre in the South Carolina church happened and the state authorities were kind of dilly-dallying about whether or not to take down the Confederate flag, the old slave state flag, she climbed the pole and took it down. And there's women like Janetta Elzey, who's a very prominent social media activist who's been at all the protests around the country as well. And these women are incredibly powerful speakers, incredibly sort of well-organized and well-connected people who are really at the heart of this movement. And I think sometimes that does go underappreciated by us in the media.
A lesson for us. I think there's a question over there.
It sounds like the count is really improving the data quality and reporting of the government. But do you see it actually changing the behaviour or even the mindset of the American police officers?
Just a quick one.
I think potentially yes, but I think there's a bit of a tidal change going on at the moment anyway, and that revolves around body cameras and around eyewitness video. So, you know, we watched the Walter Scott video there, and that is basically what has allowed this officer to be charged. There was another recent case, a guy called Samuel DeBose, who was killed in Cincinnati. Entire incident was captured on body camera, and the officer involved, a guy called Ray Tensing, basically said Mr. DeBose, who pulled over for a traffic stop, had dragged him along in his car, and that's why he had to shoot to kill him, because he was terrified he might get run over. Body camera footage comes out and it's a complete lie. You know, he basically just shot him in the head as he slightly rolled his vehicle forward. So I think, you know, we can talk about the changes that the counter is bringing about in terms of sort of, you know, top-down government and attempting to pinpoint interesting trends. But in terms of day-to-day accountability, I think it's more a question of technology and how that how that sort of moves it forward. But maybe John has a different...
Christopher, do you think it is just a matter of information? Are you in a situation where if people had the information, other police officers or wider communities really had the information about the scale of the problem, that they would react to it? Is it a matter of...
I think the information is an immense public service. I don't think, you know, as a historian of American governance and politics, that states change because of information. I think states change because of pressure. And I think right now what I see is a pattern of them making fall guys, you know, so... some particular officer involved in a particular incident gets dismissed. Mm-hmm. Oh, problem solved. We move on. And then the Black Lives Matter thing, though, is important because it's putting pressure on various elected officials who then put pressure on police the police administrations. So my hope would be from political organizing at the community level in a kind of disruptive way, you know, continuing the patterns of disruption that we've seen Black Lives Matter do, so that no business as usual can continue. That's the way it's going to change. Can I just say something, though, because Gary's thing about Americans and frontier culture and all that, I kind of loved it. And at the same time, you know, the reason I don't go on the radio anymore is it's not that I can't, you know, I could give 2 hours of Americans and violence or something if I had lecture time, but I can't do it in a minute on the radio. I can't explain my people. And I kind of agree with all that, except, you know, we're so remotely removed from that world of the frontier now. Most Americans don't own guns. You know, something like 30% do. And then they own enough guns to, you know, arm all the rest. That 30%, something like 90% of them only own one, which they use to go shoot a squirrel once a year or something like that in the woods of Kentucky. You know, we're talking about a tiny number who have arsenals, in effect. Yeah. You know, 60 weapons or whatever in the house, including a Gatling gun. To me, the problem is less cultural. The difference between Britain and America is less cultural than political in two ways, the politics. The first is the immense power of the gun manufacturers who arm the NRA with money, which is then used to bring suitcases of cash to Capitol Hill. You know, it's playing out old Gilded Age style bribery. That's what the NRA is about. And then it masquerades as a populist gun owners association. And then the second factor is the American constitutional tradition, the Fourth Amendment, and so forth. And there, here, let me lay something at your door. The British Redcoats, the famed Redcoats and their occupying force over the colonies. Hey, look, I mean, the reason why the American Constitution inscribes the right of the people to bear arms in the Bill of Rights is because of people feeling like a standing army had been an occupying force, in the same way that you're describing the police now as an occupying force. You know, what to do about the fact that the law of the land and the whole body of jurisprudence then inscribes the right of the individual to bear arms, and then how to then deal with the problem of gun control, which most Americans, you know, again and again and again in poll after poll, want there to be much more intensive gun control than exists right now. And yet those two things, the power of the gun lobby and the Constitution, block it.
Or was it Robin Williams used to say, the right to bear arms and the right to arm bears? I'm going to take... I think I've got time for one more question.
Can I add something, in terms of this discussion about the differences between the US and the UK? Because, I mean, there are an awful lot of similarities, and we can't pretend that we don't have our own over-police communities here, and we cannot pretend that over-police communities, particularly in London, Tottenham, Broadwater Farm, Brixton, you know, these sometimes have erupted into riots, right? I wouldn't want anybody to leave this room without being somewhat introspective about the atmosphere that we live in. And often this is, you know, quiet provocation, quiet injustice until buildings start getting burnt down.
Because, of course, we don't have the guns, but we have the tasers. Mm. We're pretty well stocked with tasers, and they're using them pretty regularly now. Mm. And, of course, that Oliver was saying that's the next... stage of your, or part of the next stage of what you're doing?
We had something out last month. So,
yeah. Sorry, but UK police predominantly don't have tasers. That's still a minority.
Well, the forces don't have tasers.
Yes, no, police officers numerically.
Yeah, they don't carry tasers, but all forces have them, though.
Yeah, they do. And I accept there are some armed UK police and there are some tasered UK police. That's still a minority.
Okay.
Please don't characterise it that way, because that is not quite accurate. I'm not denying that there is misuse of tasers, but please, there is a proportionate response to this, and please recognise UK policing is predominantly unarmed. A minority of police officers have guns and a minority of police officers have tasers. This is still a healthier situation for all its faults.
Well, long may it continue to be so, and I'm going to have to end it there. Thank you very much for all your questions. Can I thank my panel, Christopher Phelps, Oliver Lachlan, Gary Young, and René Edo-Lodge. Can I thank you as well, John Swain in New York. Thank you. Skype worked. I didn't think it would. Hey, now I'm a believer. said, I hope you found our debate stimulating today. This is part. You will know of our membership scheme. There are many, many events as well that you can be part of. You've gone to the website, membership, theguardian.com. Do that. Check that out. But that's all we've time for. Thank you for coming and good night.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.